And our special guest this Thanksgiving Day night, Lloyd Pye. Everything you know is wrong. Well, we're going to start by talking about ancient astronauts with Lloyd in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Lloyd Pye graduated with a Bachelor of Science degree in psychology. He joined the United States Army and became an agent for military intelligence. Now, during this time, Mr. Pye began an independent study of human evolution. At the age of 30, his studies led him to conclude that humans could not possibly have evolved on Earth according to the Darwinian paradigm. By the age of 40, he could illustrate his belief by comparing skeletons in the so-called pre-human fossil record with those reported to belong to the world's four basic types of hominids. Lloyd is probably best known in alternative circles as the caretaker of the famous Starchild skull. We'll talk about that as well tonight, the complete bone cranium that looks like a hybrid between a human and some other kind of alien being. Our guest tonight, happy Thanksgiving, Mr. Pye. How are you?
I'm doing real good, George. Thank you for having me on. It's a good night to be on.
It really is, and our pleasure. And thanks for doing this. I know a lot of people would just rather spend some time with their friends and family, but you jumped at the opportunity.
Well, I got no friends, no family. What are you talking about?
What do you mean? You have us. We're your friends and family.
Yeah, absolutely, right.
I wanted to talk for the first half hour here, Lloyd, about ancient astronauts. And tell me a little bit about what's been going on in that arena.
Well, we've got some real exciting news relative to that. We're going to be on a show this coming Monday in just a couple of days, few days, Monday night, on the National Geographic TV cable channel for those who can get it. Now, this is not a cable channel that's necessarily easy to access. A lot of people get it, but a lot of people don't. Like where I live, for example, in the panhandle of Florida, we do not get it. We do not have access to it. I think they charge a premium for it or something, and a lot of outfits won't carry it. But anyway, if you can get it, it will be an hour-long episode in the ongoing series that they have called Is It Real? And the Is It Real series looks at things like vampires and Dracula like that, and Bigfoot and werewolves, and you know they'll do an hour on each group of things like that. This hour is going to be about ancient astronauts, and so the Starchild and I were filmed as part of that show, and also on that show will be Eric von Daniken, who started the whole ancient astronauts thing back in the late 60s with his book Chariots of the Gods, and they have interviewed other people as well that will be on. So we just have to wait and see how they edited. They interviewed Zechariah Sitchin. So we just have to wait and see how it's going to be edited and how they put the show together.
You don't think it's going to be a hatchet job, though, do you?
Well, it will always be, George. These shows, I'm sure you know, and everybody that watches these kinds of shows know that you can't really get on a show like this without expecting to be hammered a certain degree. They have a pattern to them in which when they talk about any kind of material from what they call the fringe, which is what we're all interested in, they will talk about the subject or they'll let you talk about it, and they'll let you have your say, you know, some of what you want to put out, you will get on the show, no question about it. But they always come in at the end, always, with some expert who will look at some aspect of what you've said or some aspect of what you're talking about, and they will say, this is wrong, you can't believe any of that, this is why we think this is wrong, and you have to believe us because we're the experts, and sort of dismiss the whole thing. So the deal you have to make with the devil is that you get your message into millions of homes that way around the country, but you're also going to get hammered. So I don't think there's any way to escape that.
How did the appearing on the show come about for you?
Well, the producers decided that they wanted to do a show on the ancient astronauts, and they started asking around in the community of people that would know about that, and they heard about the Starchild, and its status is probably the best, most scientifically tested relic that has ever come out of our field. So they wanted to have it on if they could, and initially I was very skeptical. The individual that had told them about the Starchild and about me was Ted Strain. I don't know if you know him. He's one of the researchers and filmographers in our field. And Ted told them about it, and I talked to Ted. I was very skeptical, but Ted said he knew the people, and he felt good about them. He had worked with them before. and then I could trust them to do the best job that they could do within the parameters that they have to work within. So I, you know, took him at his word and agreed to go ahead with it. But I also knew that we were coming on up on some news in the field of genetics relative to the star child, and I knew that it was getting to be time that we could start pushing it out into the mainstream again, or push it out into the mainstream really at all. Since 2003, we'd been sort of sitting on it because of the DNA evidence. But we knew some things were in the wind. I knew some things were in the wind from talking to the geneticists. So it was kind of okay to have a show that was going to come on at the end part of this year. So that was another reason for going ahead to do it.
Well, you know, as long as they come into this with an open mind, I mean, that to me would be good.
I think that the National Geographic staff that did that, the shooting, came into it with a very open mind, and I think that they were genuinely, I mean, genuinely impressed. I think everybody that was there during the filming and everybody that talked to them later, because they filmed other people after us, and they said that they were extremely impressed with everything to do with the star child, because if you really see the evidence, and they flew out to El Paso to film at the home of the owners of the skulls, so they got to hold and deal with the real ones, and the people, when you see them on the show, you will notice in some instances you'll see a star child skull that is all complete and whole and everything looks fine. Well, that's the stereolithographic copy that we've had made to take out in public and show when I speak about it. But you will also see, I'm sure, shots of the skulls with panels cut out of their heads. I mean, just big holes up in their heads. And those are the real ones, and those are the ones that they've had those chunks taken out to do the testing that we've had done along the way.
So, well, you don't have it.
Really, it'll get to you when you're looking at the real thing and holding the real thing and feeling the incredible difference in the weight of the two. It gets to you.
How long have you been a believer that this planet was visited by extraterrestrials? I think it goes beyond the Star Child, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, it does. I started really buying into it, George, about 1990 when I first read Zechariah Sitchin's
12th planet.
When I read the 12th planet, he made such good sense, and I had already been working for years with hominoids, with Bigfoot and the abominable snowman and all that, and I absolutely knew that we didn't evolve on this planet, that they, the hominoids, are the native, indigenous, upright walking primates of this planet, and we just did not evolve here. It's clear from the fossil record, and, you know, lately we've proved it through our genes, our mitochondrial DNA. But at the time, I just knew we didn't evolve here, but I had no idea where we came from. And then, so when I read Sitchin's book, I was looking for an answer that made sense to me, and his book just made sense based on what I already knew. And so I bought into it pretty much right then, and I've been with it ever since. And then the Star Child has just, you know, confirmed it at a higher level.
Do you physically have the Star Child skull with you now?
No, the owners keep both the original skulls under lock and key, and are very, you know, very diligent about that, because obviously this is a very, very important relic, and as time goes by, and we're able to finally get the DNA done that we need done, the DNA testing done that we need done, I think it's going to be probably the most valuable thing in the world. So I've cautioned them many times, and they take good care of it.
Do they allow the media to videotape it, or can they travel with it?
They can't travel. It's not really safe to travel anymore. It's basically against the rules, against the law, to travel with human remains of any kind without special permissions. Now, we have done that. I have secured that from the government, and I have papers to that effect. But I don't really want to do it unless we're talking flying. Now, you can drive them wherever you want, of course, but
right,
it's flying. It's much more difficult since 9/11. I used to fly with them without any problem. I would just open up the box and I'd say, they're movie props, not a problem, movie props, and they just let me go through. But the movie prop line wouldn't work anymore, so they keep them, and I, like I said, keep the stereolithographic copies so that whenever I do talk about it, people can see and feel. The weights are the same, the look is the same, the paint jobs are the same. So you get a real good sense of it, but it's not quite the same as the real thing and knowing that you're in the presence of the real thing.
I want to do something, Lloyd, I haven't done with you since you've been on the program all these years. And I want you to tap into your incredible creative mind for a moment and position yourself as an ancient astronaut, and this is prior to the visitation of planet Earth. Paint for us, if you would, some kind of scenario on how they possibly discovered our planet and what the process was for wanting to visit us, and then what you think they did once they got here.
Well, if you go along with the Sitchin story, which I do, that there is another planet in our solar system called Nibiru that swings around in a long elliptical orbit rather than the circular orbits of the regular planets, then they would have known we were here, that all the planets were here, as indeed when they told the Sumerians about it, they counted from the outside in so that Earth was the seventh planet from the outside rather than the third planet from the inside. So they would have known it was here, and they would have known, I'm sure, what it was like. They may even have taken scouting trips here. So when it came time for them to need to replace part of their atmosphere, to repair part of their atmosphere, my understanding of it, according to the writings of Sitchin, is that they, in their rise to the high technology, the very high technology that they had developed on their planet, they had damaged the ozone layers, the atmosphere of their own planet, and they had to repair it. And ironically enough, in what we're doing to our planet, as we are damaging our atmosphere in our rise to a high technology, repeating the same mistake, we will have to, if we can do this, the best way, I understand, to repair our own atmosphere is to take extremely finely granulated flakes of gold, basically talcum powder, gold turned into talcum powder, and blow it up into the upper stratosphere so that it will just kind of float up there over on the air, on the blanket of air that surrounds the Earth. That thin layer of gold will go up there and dissipate and start, you know, having a protective effect, like those thin sheets of gold that they put in the windshields of certain cars.
I had
an old Peugeot that did that. You couldn't even tell it was there, and yet it made such a difference having that thin sheet of gold in the glass. It's the same thing. So it makes sense even here on Earth today. And yet when you read the Sumerians talking about it, it sounds kind of crazy. You'll hear a lot of skeptics just dismiss it, say, oh, yeah, they were coming for gold, like they couldn't find that anywhere else, and, you know, da-da-da-da. Well, maybe it is somewhere else out there, but it seemed to be here in real big, thick chunks down in South Africa, especially where it is to this day, where they do most of the gold mining. So they came, and they went down there, and they were taking it out everywhere they could get it easily off the earth. And then when they ran out of that, they had to create a slave and a servant to go start digging mines and start doing really hard work to recover it. But that's, you know, that's my understanding of how and why they came. What it would have been like when they first got here, I don't know, but apparently they were well adapted enough such that they didn't need particularly bulky spacesuits or didn't need to breathe anything differently.
Right.
So apparently the atmosphere is more or less the same, or maybe they took some little pill or something that made them able to breathe the air,
yeah,
if they needed more oxygen, whatever. I don't know, but when you see the depictions of them in the drawings and things that they've left behind on the cylinder seals, you don't see them wearing very much, but in some of the statuary, you do see things that look kind of like spacesuits. So maybe they had a little bit of an adjustment problem at the first. I'm not sure.
Now, these people who came from Nibiru, though, if I recall Sitchin's work, you know, we look like them, right?
Oh, absolutely. They said we shall make the Adamu, which is us, in our own image after our own likeness, which is a line that comes out of the Sumerian tablets right down into the Old Testament word for word. So there was there's plagiarism goes a long way back. But yeah, they were indeed very much like us. I would have to say that the reason we look so different from the other primates on this planet is not because we evolved differently, but because we are really genetically engineered to be and mostly, vastly more like those who created us than those of the stock from which they used to create us. In other words, when they got here and they wanted to make a slave and a servant, they wanted something that would be better adapted physically to the planet and naturally adapted to the planet than they were. So they took some of the stock, had to, of the creature that was here, and they're pretty clear about that, and their own, and they melded the two together. So I think that all this DNA work that's being done with Neanderthals is going to show that there's a little bit of them still in us, but vastly more. This other thing, the Anunnaki, is going to make up humanity than will be any kind of real primate DNA. It's there, even though we're talking about small amounts in terms of percentages.
Right.
1% between us and chimps, 0.5% between us and Neanderthals. With this new 4-5-4 life science technique where you can do it base pair by base pair and get the whole entire genome to lay it down gene by gene by gene by gene, all 25,000 of them, and you can compare that, you're going to see that 0.5% is in fact millions of base pairs, and they are going to be such that you'll see, I think that the researchers will see, that while the Neanderthals are much closer to the, you know, to the chimps, that little 0.5% or that 1% that makes us is going to be absolutely unique, and there will be no way that could have been done by evolution. And I think that, you know, they're just going to have to face up to the fact that we are genetically engineered and put here.
And one of the reasons I bring this up, Lloyd, is because we have had reports, obviously, of so many different kinds of aliens, extraterrestrials that have visited this planet.
Right.
The Greys, the Reptilians, the Nordiques, those that look like us,
right.
You know. So they're obviously coming from other planetary systems to visit
right.
us.
I think life is ubiquitous. I really do. I think that it's out there in a number of places. And if you go throughout the universe, it may be that it's absolutely everywhere you can find. And I think probably it's all going to be based around the same thing, the same kind of genes that we have, the same kind of DNA, which all life forms on this planet share. I have to think that that system was brought here, put here, introduced here, that it's, whether it was directed or undirected panspermia doesn't matter. It came here. It certainly didn't develop here. There's no time for it. You go from 4.5 billion years ago, a seething ball, a mass of boiling lava, and then suddenly around 4 billion years, you've got two forms of well-developed prokaryotic bacteria. That's put here. That's not developing here. That's put here. And so if you start out with it put here, there's no, you know, there's nothing against everything being put here along the way. So if it's everywhere and it's all based around the same basic building blocks of the DNA and the base pair system that builds the genes, that builds the DNA, then everything is going to sort of be kind of alike under the skin. You know, they say how all the races are so incredibly close that the differences are extremely superficial. I think that if you were to go into that bar scene in Star Wars, you know, with
all
DNA, it would be the differences between all of them would be like 0.5%, 0.75%, 1%, like that.
Stay with us. Lloyd has a new book coming out. We're going to talk with him about that on Coast to Coast AM. Lloyd, when you were back with us in December, you were talking about writing a new book. What'd you ever do with that?
Well, I finished it in about March, the latter part of March of this year, George, and I wanted to go to a mainstream publisher with it, because I think The Star Child is a serious enough subject to warrant publishing at that level if you can get it. But when I tried to do it the old way that I knew how, where you just contact editors straight out, I found out that they don't do that anymore. You pretty much at that level, you have to go through an agent. So then I had to get an agent. And one of the things that you also do nowadays that I didn't know about is you take your book to what's called a book doctor, who is generally an old retired editor who has a lot of experience. And they're not working 9-to-5 anymore, but they still keep their hand in by editing books for people to make them as good as they can be before publication. So I found out who the top science book doctor was, a man named Paul DeAngelis, and hired him to go through it. And working together, we polished it just as well as we could. And then I ended up getting through him, I got a very top-notch agent, but it's her first time to deal with a book like this from, you know, quote, the fringe.
It's not like you get one of these every day.
Yeah, right, exactly. It's well, and not at the mainstream level. You know, there's a whole group of publishers out there who will publish in our field
right. Very
easily. You know, it isn't that we can't get it published, but to get it published at the highest level so that it has the best chance of reaching the most markets, it's an uphill slog the whole way. So we've notified a number of editors who we think might have some interest in this, maybe on, you know, an outside chance, and we've told them about the show on Monday night, and we've asked them to watch it and see how it makes them feel, and if they would like to know more about it at that point, to let us know, to let my agent know, and we'll send them a manuscript and see what they think. So we're hoping to have something in place by the end of this year, maybe, or early part of next year, and certainly, everyone can count on this, certainly. The book will be out and in stores by the end of next year. I don't know if you're aware of this, but when you sell a book, from the time you sell it, it's approximately a year before it hits the shelves.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so I've got the hours out, Worker in the Light. And it took me about 2 years, Lloyd, to get that thing rolling.
So there you go. So anyway, it's going to be out by the fall of next year for sure, because no matter what, whether we get a mainstream publisher to take it or if we go with just a smaller house, one of the houses that normally publishes our kind of book, we are going to get it published. We are going to get it out. It's a good book, and I think it has a chance to penetrate the mainstream market. And I think in the course of 2007, The Star Child is going to move into mainstream awareness through a number of avenues, and it'll break out of, you know, it's well known in the world of alternative knowledge. It's an icon even, but it's very unknown in the mainstream world. So this is going to be its year, I think, to break out, because we know now that we're going to be able to get an answer to what it actually is by the end of the decade. So we feel confident in asserting that the answer is probably going to be definitively that it's not entirely human.
What happens if this television program takes a pot shot at the Star Child? Will that affect publishing of the book?
Definitely, that's a risk, George, and it's definitely a possibility, and we all just have to watch and see what happens. But I can tell you all what basically the pattern will be. They will let us say some very good and very positive things about it. They'll let us show it and you know, tell what we think supports it. And then there will be some expert who will come on, and he'll pick some small part of it. I don't know what, but some part of it, and he'll say, you see, we can show you an example where you see this particular characteristic. And so the whole thing is just, you know, throw the baby out with the bathwater and don't worry about it. They never address all of the issues that are involved. The Star Child is a very, very complex thing. It has a dozen major things wrong with it just around its, you know, just on its outer surface. That's not even talking about the fact that its bone is half as thick as it ought to be, weighs half as much, is 2 or 3 times as hard, has these fibers laced through the bone that is not seen ever in any kind of bone, any other bone in history, not human bone, not mammalian bone, not reptilian bone, not bird bone, not dinosaur bone. The fibers that are interlaced in that bone are absolutely unique, and that's apparently what gives it its durability.
We have so many new listeners all the time, Lloyd, who are probably saying, what is this Star Child? So can you give us a brief overview again, and then I want to talk a little bit more about your efforts here to get this thing published.
The Star Child skull is a real, true bone skull that was found in Mexico and buried in a mine tunnel in Mexico in the high desert country around the Copper Canyon area. And it was found in 1930. It was carbon-14 tested as about 900 years old, so it died about 900 years ago. The lady that found it, she didn't know what she had. It was to her like a souvenir. She kept it in a cardboard box till she died. Then she handed it to another couple, and then another couple that now have it got it. And the woman in that couple, now they've come out of the owners, you know, have been incognito for most of the years that I've been doing this, but they decided to come out of the woodwork for the National Geographic show, so I can tell you who they are. It's Ray and Melanie Young of El Paso, Texas.
Okay.
And so Melanie, it turned out, was a neonatal nurse. So when she saw that skull, she knows what deformity looks like, what it's supposed to feel like, what it's supposed to look like, and she knew that was not human deformity, just from her own experience. But, of course, knowing that and proving it are two different things, and so that's how they contacted me and asked me if I would try to, you know, go about proving it, and that's what I've been trying to do for all these years. It's a hard thing to prove. But anyway, that's it. The skull has the outward shape, I mean the outward parts rather, of a human skull. It's got a frontal bone, it's got an occipital, two parietals, two temporals, two sphenoids. It's got the parts, but the parts are all rearranged, very rearranged,
weird,
put together in a new pattern. It's got a neck about half as big around as our neck. It's got cheeks and lower face about half or less the size of ours. It's got eyes that are sitting down in the middle of its nose instead of up at the top of its nose.
And how big? How big are the eye sockets compared to ours?
The eye sockets are very shallow relative to ours, so the eyes that go in there, assuming they're eyes like ours, are going to be substantially different. Or either that or they're going to bug off the face an awful lot, and we don't really think that. So the eyes
are they bigger?
Excuse me?
Are they bigger? The eye sockets?
The eye sockets are much smaller. They're smaller and they have a different shape. But
okay,
the main thing, George, is they're about a little less than half as deep, and the parts, the openings, what are called the foramen openings for the optic nerve and the blood vessels and veins, nerves that serve the rest of the eye to make it move. Those are squeezed down to the bottom from where they normally sit. But the thing about it is, with all of these differences, with all of these physiological differences, it's perfectly symmetrical. It's put together beautifully. It's, in fact, in many ways, it's more symmetrical than an average human being. It's very, very well put together. But it's got, it's got a much larger brain than should be in a head that size. It's got a dent down the back of the head, a little dent. You know, you see pictures of grays. I can remember, I always see that little dent, that kind of heart-shaped dent in the top of their heads.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, what's that about? And yet you see this skull, and boom, there's
It has one of the.
It has one of those dents, exactly.
You call it the Star Child. How do we know it's not an alien that happens to be small?
You know, George, one of the big mistakes that I made was calling it Star Child right out of the box, because that is right away an indication that we believe that, you know, we're not balanced, in other words. As far as science goes, when I talk to the science, or when I talk to scientists or the media or anybody, when the word Star Child has to come out, right away that just their hackles rise. That was a mistake. However, we did it because one of the other pieces that we have of it, we only have the two pieces. We have the cranium itself, and we have the upper right maxilla. That's your upper jaw, the right half of it. And we have that, and it has teeth in it and everything. Well, when we did one of the first tests we did was x-ray it, and we found that in that upper maxilla there are teeth waiting to come down. And, in fact, the three front teeth were not in the holes anymore, and you could look in the holes and see that there were teeth in there ready to come down. So we just looked at each other, and of course, the experts that we were dealing with at the time, the dentist at the time, said, wow, it's a child. You got teeth up in the upper part of the maxilla. That means that it's a child of about 5 or 6 years old.
Sure, who hadn't had his adult teeth yet?
Star child, and went with that. But later, then people began to argue about what the skull itself, the way the sutures are put together, the way the skull itself is put together, it looks older than a child. So there's debate still to this day. I'm still believing it's probably a child, but it could have been a very, very old adult that had the capacity to grow new teeth as it needed them.
Okay, so the new book, is it based on the star child?
Well, the new book is actually it's a memoir of the 7 years that I've been dealing with this, and it goes from an opening scene of how we think the star child came to be where it was found, and then it goes through Ray and Melanie acquiring the skull and then moving it forward to the next level, asking people in MUFON to take a look at it and see what they thought, and then bringing me into it, and then all of the effort that I had to take it through, the different scientists that I had to take it to. And but it's told as a story with a plot. You know, it isn't just a dry recitation of scientific facts. There's a lot of focus on the people, on the characters involved, because it's also a human story as well of difficulty and struggle and ups and downs and some very low downs and some very nice ups as well. So I tried to take the lesson I think that the Da Vinci Code taught us all, which is that you can get people to swallow a lot of science if you wrap a real nice, compelling, moving story with it. Now, mine is not as dramatic or as fast-paced as the Da Vinci Code, but it will get you through it, and you'll feel like you've been taken on a ride by the end of it. And I think that readers will, all the pre-readers, the people who've read it up to this point, have really felt it was a good, compelling, and moving story, and I think it's going to do well.
Might be a movie.
It could be, especially if, of course, we get the result that we think we're going to get in the next couple of years. I don't see how it couldn't be not just a movie, but probably documentaries and all kinds of things. Yeah, it could be a very, very big deal.
One of the reasons why I was asking if you can travel with this skull is because I'm working on a few pilot programs for the Sci-Fi cable network, and I am pretty sure that the pilots will get this entire concept to a full-time air program. So we'll be doing a sci-fi show and coast-to-coast radio, obviously.
Great.
Which is my baby now.
Great.
But I'm wondering if you would be a guest on the Sci-Fi Network with us, but what do we do about the skull?
Well, you can do just exactly what the National Geographic people did. We'll get the skulls where you need them to be. We'll have to drive them. We gave them that option. We said we can take them anywhere you want. But
taping would be in Los Angeles.
It's easy enough to move them that way. We just have to know when and where. And
all right.
But yeah, we can get them to you. Not a problem. But keep in mind, as we told them, they're dramatically injured. There's just no way around it. And we can't get them fixed. We can't get them repaired until we know that the testing that we'll have to do is completely finished. But when it's over, then a company in Los Angeles, ironically enough, called Bone Clones, which specializes in the recreation of museum examples of skeletons and bones. For example, if you have a saber-toothed tiger in your museum and you want a copy of that saber-toothed tiger in another museum, you send the original to Bone Clones. They clone it. They clone it exactly. They paint it to look alike. You can't tell the difference.
What do they make it out of, plaster or something?
Yeah, well, they make it out of whatever. Yeah, it's a kind of plaster.
Something synthetic, okay.
But it's really great to watch how they operate. So Bone Clones can take the originals and patch them up, and it won't be the same. I mean, there's no way they can make it exactly the same, but they will look for display purposes in a museum, which is where obviously they would wind up. They will look close enough. It'll be really neat.
Bone Clone, is it a Hollywood type company? I mean, do they movies and stuff?
No. They do, I'm sure, work for Hollywood, but mostly they work for museums. Recreating rare examples of things that other museums want to have an example of. You know, there's only so many great saber-toothed tigers out there. There's only so many great mastodons. There's only so, you know. And so what Bone Clones does is it clones the original so that other museums can have examples of what they want. So it's a great, whoever thought of that, but it's a great thing to do.
Oh my God. Is it expensive to do something like that?
Yeah, I tell you, if anybody listening to this, if you want to see a great catalog of things that they offer for sale, get the Bone Clones catalog. You will just be amazed. It's so beautiful the way the art, you know, the photography and everything. You can buy for your office a skull of virtually any animal there is. You can buy a full skeleton of virtually any animal there is. It's for sale at Bone Clones. It's amazing.
Give us general, we'll go to the catalog. I love stuff like
that. All you have
like
to do
this.
Is just Google Bone Clones and boom, you're right there.
I'm telling you, online people must love me because I go to, you know, catalogs like this. Sea Crane has got a great one now. I got to tell you about what he's been doing. Well, I can't tell you about what he's doing because it's a secret project. But he's got it's one of those catalogs, Lloyd, that when you keep it, when you get it, you don't want to lose it. You just kind of keep. And I bet Bone Clone's the same way.
I've got them stacked up in drawers. I can't bring myself to throw them away. They're just so beautiful.
One of my favorite guests on Coast to Coast, and I love them all, but one of my favorites is Michael Cremo, who talks about forbidden archaeology.
Right.
You also fit that category. You're a favorite guest. When you come on, it's exciting for me and the listeners. When we come back at the top of the hour, tell me about what your work is with the human origins and what's going on in that arena.
Great. I love Michael, too.
Are you a believer that mankind, intelligent mankind, has been around for a long time?
No, Michael does.
Yeah,
we disagree on that, and we can talk about it when we come back after the break. But I feel that we're what our genes say we are. We're recent here, and he believes that we've been here for millions of years. I don't deny that somebody was here, but it wasn't us.
That's interesting, too. We'll be back in a moment. Lloyd Pye, our guest. If you want his websites, they're linked up at coasttocoastam.com. But one is called starchildproject.com. The other is lloydpye.com. Well, I went to the Bone Clone website. I think we have crushed the Bone Clone website by the millions that have just hit it. But what a neat, neat website. Lloyd is right. We'll be back with him in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Lloyd, let's talk a little bit now, if we can, about Michael Cremo and some of his work, some of your work, why you two don't agree, and we'll talk about the human origins and the intervention theory. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, Michael and I agree about a lot in that I believe that his uparts, his out-of-place artifacts, are genuine and real, and I think that the dates are probably accurate on these things that they find, you know, like gold chains embedded in a lump of coal that, you know, goes back millions of years. I don't really argue that. Where we differ is in what left those artifacts behind.
Mm-hmm.
Michael, because of his involvement with, the Hare Krishna and the beliefs, the Ayurvedic belief system, I think it is that human beings have been on the earth for millions of years. He comes at it from that standpoint. The problem is that our genes, as we are, as you and I are, and he is, indicate that we're only about 200,000 years old as this kind of body that we carry around now. So something clearly was here, leaving those things behind millions of years ago, but it wasn't us. It was somebody else. But his argument is just if it was here, it had to be us. And to me, that really doesn't make sense. So I go with the genetics, which is that we are only 200,000 years old approximately. But I also believe that his dating and his book is just so, I mean, his research is just so overwhelming and so awesome. You can't doubt that somebody was here, but it's what you were talking about earlier. There are so many other types of beings supposedly out there, including the ones that look like us, the Nordics, the Pleiadians, the Lyrans. I mean, there's a whole list of different names just for the human-looking types. And then you have the different gray types. There are multiple gray types. There's the tall ones, there's the short ones, there's the hybrid-looking ones. There's the reptilians, there's the insectoids, and even there's the little blue men. They're the rare ones, but the little blue men look like fireplugs painted blue. And they, you know, I mean, you got an amazing array just within our neighborhood. So who knows what's out there over the grand scheme of things.
Do you think this planet is unusual, Lloyd? I mean, you look around and, I mean, look at all the vegetation life and the human-type life. I mean, we're all different and the same, of course. Animal life, fish in life. I mean, it just an abundance of life on this planet. Are we unusual?
I think it could be a laboratory of some kind, George. I really do. I think we're an experiment, and I think a lot of things could be experiments here. And I'll tell you why. Because when a planet normally forms, if they form the way we think they do, and it looks like they do, a sun begins to coalesce, and streamers of material from around that began to coalesce into planetoids. When all that happens in the vacuum of space, everything works pretty much the same way as you see in all the other planets except Earth. The liquid that it forms into, the seething, mass that it forms into, and you see it in the space filming all the time from the, anytime you're in space. When you let a liquid go in space, what does it do? It pulls itself immediately into the smallest spherical ball that it can. Any liquid you let go in space,
right,
you see that happen. That's automatic. So all of the planetoids, the planets, the planetesimals, everything that can, while they're in a liquid state, are going to pull into the tightest ball that they can. So what amazes me is there would be life elsewhere, because it seems like it could only pretty much exist here. But obviously that's wrong. But what makes Earth special, and I do think it's very special, is that if you go by Sitchin's theory that there was a collision and half of the Earth got knocked away, and so it recoalesced while it still could, but its outer surface was broken into plates, i.e. the tectonic plates that we have. So it left like a big hole in the surface that over time made the area that the oceans take up now. I don't think there's any degree of water anywhere else like we have. I think that's what makes us really unique, so much water.
What if we're a farm, Lloyd? What if we are the farm, the harvesting, where they come down and pick up vegetation, animal life, insect life, human life, and off they go again? I mean, we do have people disappearing all the time.
We do. We have people disappearing all the time, but we also have things appearing here also in the past. If you look at the history of this planet, there have been a number of catastrophic extinction events where massive die-offs occur, anywhere from 90% at the Permian to anywhere from 40, 30, sometimes 15 and 20% gone. Everything, down that much. So you've had these catastrophic die-offs, and yet when the new atmosphere, whatever the new situation is after that event stabilizes itself, boom, suddenly you get whole new thousands of new life forms in a very short time coming. So it's like we're being a farm is a good way to put it. It's like we're being controlled and just whatever they come and they look and they say, okay, this atmosphere will now support this kind of creatures, let's bring in some of those, and you get a whole new rack of them, and what they bring lives, and what what is able to survive in the new environment from the old animals, they continue to live on. It's amazing. So I think we're probably terraformed. That's the word that I use. We're like an ant farm. We're being terraformed. And I think probably from the very beginning, when prokaryotic life was first put here, and what they did was they changed the atmosphere such that all the iron got tied up with oxygen, turned into rust, so that you could have free oxygen in the atmosphere. And once that was done, after about 2-3 billion years, then you could put higher life forms in. And they've gradually, the Earth has been shaped into what it is, and its atmosphere, I think, has been shaped into what it is by the introduction of certain life forms over time. And whoever's doing this, George, understand, whoever's doing this, they have no concept of time. Time means absolutely nothing to them, obviously,
because they're just
able to take the real long view and let it play out as it needs to play out to create whatever it is they're trying to create.
Is this what you call, then, the intervention theory?
Right. This is the basic groundwork of the intervention theory, that there's been intervention here on Earth from the very beginning, from the introduction of the very first life forms, the two types of prokaryotic bacteria, right on through the eukaryotes, which were another one-cell type of creature, but much, much bigger and much more complex and sophisticated than the prokaryotes. It's like whenever it's time for a new thing to be here, it comes. And whatever is needed, that's what comes. How does that? That's not evolution. That is clearly somebody
listening.
There's a plan, and the plan is being followed, whatever the plan is.
Do you think, then, that when these ancient astronauts visited us, that whatever life forms were on this planet at the time, intelligent life forms, misconstrued them to be gods?
Well, I don't. The human beings that were here were like us 200,000 years ago. They made us, so they were already here when
right.
we got here. They made us, so we. Later, whenever any beings would come and visit primitive human beings, let's say 50,000 years ago, or 30,000 years
right.
ago, or anything like that, we're still there. Whenever anybody would then come down, of course they'd be construed as gods, because they would be relative to them. How could they interpret them as anything else? So when the Sumerians were dealing with the Anunnaki living and working among them, they didn't use the word gods in the way we use the word big G God. Gods were, to them, just the bosses. They created them, and they were working for them, and they were the bosses. But yet still, they understood that they were all powerful, all-knowing, all those things as well. But they were still flesh and blood beings who could die and did die and were just the bosses, but Uber bosses, maybe is a better way to put it.
I've noticed that you've revamped your websites.
Oh, I have been so blessed to have a wonderful woman named Amy come into my life, and we're married now.
When did this happen?
Earlier this year, back in April. And she is my web mistress, and she is really, really good at this, I think. So one of the things she did when we met and she started coming into my life was she says, I am going to have to fix your website, because I had a Stone Age level website. So mine were terrible by comparison to what was out there. So she has just been doing a yeoman job on it, and she's really turned it around. And anybody that hasn't seen either of those websites in a long time, you are going to be so impressed at the wonderful work that she's done.
What about the content? What new things are you plopping in?
Oh, got some really, I think, interesting things on the Star Child website. For example, you can go now and see what's called a phantomorph of the Star Child. We found an artist named Rob Roy Menzies up in Alaska. And he is really, really good, and he's taken a lot of time, and we've gone through a lot of back and forth to get a depiction of a being that we think looks the most like the Star Child that we can come up with based on what we know. And we took a picture of the Star Child skull, then we took an X-ray of that same front view of the Star Child skull, And then Rob Roy built a face around to fit that. And Amy found this program called Phantom Morph that allows you to do to morph several pictures together. And she created that morphing shot. And that's one of the things that you can find on the Star Child Project website. There's that. We also have on that same site, I've been getting all kinds of emails about Morgellons disease.
I want to talk with you about that because I noticed that's on your website.
Right. Well, you know, the fibers that are embedded in the bone of the star child, which are, you know, you can go and see the slideshows there and see those fibers. When those Morgellons people would see that, they'd say, this must be like Morgellons, you know. And so I'd get all these emails. And I'd say, well, Morgellons is a disease that erupts in the skin, and this is embedded in the bone, and this is 900 years ago, and Morgellons seems to be brand new, caused by, you know, who knows what, spraying in the sky or, you know, chemtrails, who knows what Morgellons is from, but it doesn't seem to be an old thing. So there are a lot of things that indicate they're not the same, but nonetheless, we've put a comparison up as best we could so people could, you know, see the facts as we know them and decide for themselves. But we don't really think what's in the star child bone is related to the Morgellons issue, but the Morgellons issue still is something, you know, very important and I think needs to get continued careful observation to see what's going on there.
Oh, it's an affliction that is driving some people absolutely crazy, Lloyd.
From what I've heard, yeah, it's something I certainly wouldn't want to get, and I don't think anybody would. And because it's so new, there's really no treatment for it at this point that I'm aware of, anyway.
Well, that's absolutely true. Well, you know, there's a scientist that's been working on what was called red rain that fell over the lands of India.
Right.
And nobody really knew at the time what it is. And he's beginning to get to the point where he's concluding that this might have come from outer space, which the theory then of panspermia might absolutely be correct, that we were seeded in some form or fashion and life jump-started here on the planet. Why can't we get a guy like that to look at the star child and help you out with a DNA check?
Well, the DNA check, you know, George, it's a good subject to talk about because people, the whole issue of the star child's DNA is what it hinges on. And let's go over the background a little bit and catch up to where we are because it's really interesting. When we did the DNA testing in 2003 at Trace Genetics in California, what they found was, notwithstanding the fact that the bone was so hard to cut, but when they put the little chips in the test tubes and then poured the EDTA on them, that's the liquid that dissolves the bone. Now, if you mm-hmm. take normal human bone and you put that liquid on it and you put the test tube on a rocker arm back and forth, a week later, that bone is gone and you just have the liquid in there, and that's how they go about getting the DNA from it. The star child bone didn't dissolve in a week or 2 weeks or 2 months or 6 months. They just left it rocking. It never dissolved a shred. They had to take another piece of it and dissolve it with a very strong detergent. So right away that told them something was very weird about the bone. But then when they went to recover the DNA, they found that it's mitochondrial DNA, which comes down from the mother, came up very clear in the gels, was a very easy read. So the assumption was that the nuclear DNA would be the same because it was buried in a mine tunnel. There was really no degradation to speak of in the bone. So it should have been a very easy recovery of the nuclear DNA. But no, in seven attempts, seven different full-blown attempts, there was not the slightest bit of recovery. Now, what does that tell you? That Dad's DNA, there's something very wrong, very unusual about the father's DNA. But just for us to know that, to know that the father's DNA is not entirely human, is not to prove what it is. It's just to say the primers, the chemical primers, are not recovering it. So this new technique that was announced all over the news just last week, I can't believe the irony of the timing of this, but most of you, your listeners, will have seen something about them announcing that they have recovered the first million base pairs of Neanderthal DNA.
So which is a great story.
Yeah,
great story.
It's a fabulous thing. It's a great step forward in science, because now they're going to be able to compare for the differences between a zebra and a horse, or a mountain gorilla and a lowland gorilla, or a chimpanzee and a bonobo. They'll be able to find out where the differences lie, because they'll be able to compare gene by gene by gene by gene. It's a wonderful thing to be able to sequence something base pair by base pair, because the old chemical primer thing that was failing on the star child was it would be strings of DNA that were human only. So if it wasn't human DNA, it's like a lock and key. The human only key would not go in the star child's locks. It wouldn't find what it was seeking. But now they will be able to do just like they're doing the Neanderthal, which also is not human. The same thing wouldn't work on the Neanderthals, just like it wouldn't work on the star child, because the Neanderthal is not entirely human. You had to be entirely human for those primers to work. So with this, you do base pair by base pair, and whatever shows up is what you got, what you have. So the star child's father's DNA will be able to be recreated in its entirety and laid down against the genes of humans, and you will be able to see what the differences are. So by the end of this decade, right now the process is slow. They say it's going to take 2 more years to finish the 3 billion base pairs that are in the average genome using this new 454 life science technology, and that's understandable. But as the process is streamlined, that time is going to drop from 2 years to a year to probably 6 months. So we should have the star child completely sequenced, according to my geneticists, by the end of this decade. In the next 2 or 3 years, somewhere in there, we'll know, absolutely know, what this thing is. And almost certainly it's going to be not entirely human, clearly substantially different from a human being, that father's DNA. So this, we're sitting on the edge of a monstrous story here. People don't know it out in the mainstream, but we, within the community of alternative knowledge, have had a pretty good idea about the star child for quite some time now. I know you have, and your listeners. Sure. We've all kind of followed this path together. But with this new breakthrough that has just been announced, which I did know about for some, I've known about it for some months now, because my geneticists within the grapevine, they know what's going on. But it's very, very big news, and not just for all of science, but for us.
You ready to talk about Bigfoot, Lloyd, when we come back?
Absolutely, love to.
We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast with Lloyd Pye. Lloyd, Bigfoot, what's been going on in that arena?
Well, a couple of things, but if I could, let me pause for a minute to catch up on something that I'd like to go to what we were talking about earlier. In reference to Amy, she asked me to let all the listeners know, and you and all the listeners know, that whatever the show Monday night, whatever the National Geographic show is going to do or say about the star child that might be of a negative nature, as soon as we know what it is, and we know there has to be something, we will have an answer for it up on the website within a day or so.
Okay,
so
good.
See our answer to whatever they do, so you can see the truth, basically. So
do you want to come back on the show for that first hour that day and either rebut it or thank the program?
Sure, that would be wonderful. That's a great idea.
Yeah, let's do that. If you get back with
that
our producers,
that would be Tuesday the 28th.
So Tuesday the 28th is the night it airs, which means
No. It would air Monday night. It airs Monday night the 27th. So
why don't we have you?
You mean me come on? Oh, okay. You mean
how about
night,
Monday night?
Night?
Yeah, it already would have been on.
Sure, that'd be fine. Absolutely.
Okay, we'll take care of it.
Because I'll know by then what I'm, what I've seen and what to tell you.
Okay, good.
Perfect. That'd be great.
Excellent.
Now,
they may simply say we don't know what the star child skull is.
I don't think it's possible. I've had so many people write me that have seen all the other episodes of the series, of the Is It Real series,
right?
And they all say that it has a very firm pattern that really fits the pattern of all most other mainstream shows like this. I'm hoping maybe that you, with the thing that you're going to be doing with sci-fi, you may be able to work around that a little bit. But the pattern of these shows, and I know everybody's very familiar with it, is whatever they let come on, they're always going to have experts to come on at the end and say it isn't really what they think it is, it's what we say it is, and they leave it at that. So I'm sure it'll be something like that, and we'll just, you know, you take the hit because, again, you're getting your message out to millions of people that you wouldn't otherwise get it out to.
All right. Bigfoot stories continue to flood into the coast-to-coast phone lines. This creature's got to be around here, Lloyd. It's got to be real.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you can't have so many thousands of, you know, basically good-hearted people claiming that they've had sightings. You can't have so much very good evidence, particularly footprint evidence. You just can't have it and have it all be a fantasy. It just doesn't work that way. It's not one of these mutual hallucination things that they try to give as an answer for it and all that. But more importantly than that, George, look, I've just posted, for those who might be interested, on my personal website, LloydPye.com, I've just posted a new 5,000-word essay about intervention, and it gives some of the background to why evolution isn't really the answer, creationism isn't the answer, intelligent design, and sort of the history of things. And one of the things that fits into that very nicely is that there is an answer for what these creatures are, but it's just totally ignored by the mainstream. There are creatures called Miocene apes that are very well known in the archaeological record. And Miocene apes start at about 25 million years ago, and they end at about 5 million years ago. So they have about a 20 million year run, these Miocene apes do. And there are two types of them. There are what's called the long-armed apes, and they're what's called the short-armed apes. Now, when I say ape, I mean no tail. We're talking not a monkey, we're talking an ape. The long arms and the short arms. The long arms have arms that are longer than their legs, so that makes them clearly quadrupeds, what we have with us today that are considered primates, chimps, gorillas, like that. Then you have what are called the short-arm Miocene apes. You don't hear a lot about them. Why? Because their arms were the same length as their legs. Now, our arms, human arms, are shorter than our legs. So if you're an ape with arms as long as your legs, you can't really walk easily as a quadruped. So what's the answer for how they locomoted? They were like knuckle draggers. They were bent over real bad, and their arms were like dangling down to the ground. Mm-hmm. Well, that's stupid. That's just stupid. Why wouldn't they just stand upright and walk? It would be so much easier than having their upper trunk have to be supported, you know, leaning. It's like walking like Groucho Marx, but worse.
Right.
That's stupid.
Exactly.
So I say that it was the short-arm Miocene apes that were alive and well for 20 million years, are still alive and well today, have been alive and well for the whole time, just like the quadrupeds are alive, and that they are the hominoids, the Bigfoot, the Sasquatch, and that's why you have different ones, because you had different short-arm Miocene apes, and you have different types of hominoids around the world. To me, it's an obvious and easy answer and a clear connection to make.
They must be huge, though, Lloyd, because people are reporting that these creatures are 7 or 8 feet tall.
Well, that's the largest. Understand, there are four basic kinds, George. There's the giant kind, which is the Bigfoot Sasquatch kind, and they are indeed like 7, 8, 9 feet tall. But then you have the more man-sized kinds. When I say man-sized, we're talking 5 to 7 feet tall. And those are the Almas of Russia and places like that. But you also have the man-sized kind around here. And then you have the also man-sized, again, 5 to 7 feet tall, are the abominable snowman, the Yeti types. There are those. And then there are the small kind, the pygmy kind, the Sedapas and the Agagwes, and the Hobbit of Indonesia that was found. And everybody's baffled by how you can have an upright walking being with a big, robust body and a very tiny peanut of a brain. That's nothing more than a Sedapa or an Agagwe as they're classically described in the hominoid literature. But, you know, again, the mainstream can't afford for this these things to be real because it opens so many cans of worms for them, notwithstanding the complete black eye it gives them all. They just are fending this off as long as they can. But there's no question that they're real, and there's no question that they have been, like I said earlier, they have been the upright indigenous, you know, the indigenous upright walking primates of planet Earth are the hominoids, and they go back as far as the apes, the chimps and the gorillas go. All the Miocene apes together, the long arms and the short arms, were out there and living and thriving, and there's no reason at all for any of them to have gone extinct. They just live where we don't live, and that's what people don't understand about hominoids. They have as much of the world to live in as we do. Fully half of the globe has never been fully explored by anybody on foot. In America, half of America is that way. Half of the United States, half of Canada, more of Canada actually, lots of Canada has never had a foot, human foot on it. The world is not what we think it is. We're led to believe that we've explored every square inch. That is not even close to reality. And those places where we don't go, where we don't live, where all we do is maybe cut a road through it, that is their territory. That is where they live. And they can go entire lifespans and never see a human being, never even know that humans exist.
Do you ever get questioned about your expertise in this area?
Well, when I do lectures, of course, yeah, I do. Why?
I mean, do you get asked to do films or anything like that?
Well, no, because there's not a lot of filmmaking that gets done in this field, you know. And when there is, there are people who have had sighting experiences, and that's usually who they go to. And I've never had a sighting experience. I'm more like an academic, you know. I just study it and I know a lot about it, but I haven't actually seen one. And there's so many people out there with such compelling encounter stories that, I mean, if I were a filmmaker, that's who I'd want to get to, I think, is to hear it from someone who can really have a visceral reaction to it. I just get excited, as you can hear, because I know this thing about the Miocene apes, and I can't get academics to acknowledge how obvious and clear that is. But I would love to, you know, I've done it. If you go, I have, you know, I've done presentations, DVDs. I have a thing on my website where I'm answering some questions about it. But this is just a subject that filmmakers don't deal with very much, George, and they should. They should, because
the evidence
is so compelling when you look at it, and it's so obvious when you put it down to the level of the Miocene apes and you see the gradations from them to where we are now with all of these sightings. To me, it just leaps out. I don't know why so many people can't seem to see it. But when you know the facts, when you know about the Miocene apes, when you know what the problem is with the short arms and how they're just sort of left off the table because there's not an easy explanation for them, there is an easy explanation for them. They are the hominoids, no question in my mind.
When you wrote the book, Everything You Know Is Wrong, why did you do that? What was the impetus that made you say, you know what, I'm going to write a book about this stuff?
Well, it's a good question. I had been a fiction writer for a number of years, and I had been a screenwriter in Hollywood, so I knew how to write, but I had been studying this field of hominoids all this time, like 20 years. And I absolutely knew what I'm telling you about, that we didn't evolve here, that the planet really belonged to these creatures and the gorillas and the chimps, you know, that it was their planet,
right,
and that we came here somehow, but I didn't know how. And then when I read The 12th Planet, Sitchin's book, then I had an answer, and I knew that I had something he didn't have, and he had something I didn't have, and I knew that if I put those two together, I could create something that would be new and valuable and would be valid. And so that's when I made the decision to switch from fiction writing to this. And so then I started deeply researching it and putting together the material that ended up in Everything You Know Is Wrong.
Why is Everything we know wrong? I mean, why isn't science telling us the truth? Why isn't the mainstream media telling us the truth?
It's the old Jack Nicholson line. They think we can't handle the truth.
That's right.
They think they know better. They think we're like children, and they are like parents, and we can't handle the truth, and so they just don't tell us. But also, the truth threatens, I think, their power positions, their power bases. For example, I mean, there's story after story after story of science willfully ignoring the truth when it was staring them in the eye because it was an inconvenient thing for them to deal with. The classic example within the last 100 years or so was plate tectonics, when Alfred Wegener in 1915 published his great book recounting how his proofs of how the plates, how the continents had to have been together at some time in the past. Absolutely had to, and he proved it. He showed how the mountains in North America and the Appalachians in North America and certain mountains in Africa were all the same.
Right.
And how mountains down in South America were the same, and how freshwater fish and rivers in America, you know, he proved it, George. He proved it all around the world. Great proofs, no question about it, but he didn't have a mechanism for how they could have moved. He just knew that they did. Well, his own era just simply would not accept it, because not because it wasn't true. Everybody could see it was true. But they didn't want to have to deal with what it meant. They didn't want to have to deal with rewriting the books. They didn't want to have to deal with confessing that they didn't understand it and that a weatherman beat them to the punch. A lot of reasons that two generations of scientists had to die before they were comfortable enough with the idea of looking for the proof of the mechanism, and they found it in the 1950s with the spreading seafloor plates. So it's kind of like that. It's just so uncomfortable for them to deal with big jumps in reality. I think it's Rupert Sheldrake that has the great line about science gives you the impression of just wading out into the great unknown with their swords flying, just hacking away at the unknown like great brave warriors, you know. And he says the truth of it is they creep forward on dainty toes toward the almost unknown. And I really like that, because that's kind of what they do. They'll only move in incremental, tiny, small steps. The big steps have to be forced on them. They don't do that willingly.
What do you think the most dangerous possible problem is for all of us on this planet? An asteroid hitting us, a massive tsunami wiping out shores, rising waters, us? What do you think? What do you think is going to do us in, if anything?
Well, I'll tell you, this is a topic of dinner conversation an awful lot, because people wonder about 2012. I think we all do.
Yeah.
And my thought on it is this: if anybody knew something in the past, if there was like a time travel thing, 2012 would seem to me to be the time when it was going to happen. And when they asked me, well, what might 2012 be? I think what you said, an asteroid would probably be the thing that they couldn't really do anything about, especially if it's a really big one. I don't really know. It would seem that if they knew it far enough in advance, they could push it a little bit out of the way. But maybe there's some kind of system in place where you can't. You just can't interfere with the way things are going to be. So my understanding of it is that an asteroid would be so dark and so black, it would have no luminosity whatsoever if it's of a certain kind, so that it would be so close that by the time our astronomers picked it up, it would be, you know, there'd be really nothing you could do. So I think that is a concern for me. As far as us doing ourselves in, I don't see that in the short term, although like I've heard you say in that clip during the breaks, if we were to say nuke Iran, something like that, then, you know, that would just be nuts, but things can happen. Then I think we'd all have real problems with the after effects of that. But just from, if we can avoid that, if we can avoid doing it to ourselves, the only external thing I see is the possibility of the asteroid just coming out of nowhere and
right.
being so close to us by the time we see it that we can't do anything.
Really, it's just too late. I know it. What horror that would be.
Yes.
Getting that kind of news report. I'd hate to be on the air at that moment. It's a catch-22. I'd love to be on the air at that moment, but I'd hate to be on the air to announce that this planet just got hit in some huge city, Paris, London,
right.
Sydney, Australia, got wiped out by
an
asteroid.
Where you really don't want to get it is in the oceans, because then everything on either side of that hit is going to get it for about
gone.
50 miles inland, you know. So
I agree. Even the tallest buildings will get it.
Yeah. That would be a real disaster. I don't think, though, it would be one of those things where it just hits out of the blue. I think they'll see it coming, because it'll start blotting out stars when it's, you know, so I think we'll all have time to, as the old saying goes, reach over and, you know, bend over and kiss yourself goodbye.
Well, you know, they may be able to pinpoint, Lloyd, where it's going to hit, at least.
I think they would. I do think they would. And I think that would be causing the greatest mass exodus and panic imaginable. It would be horrible. I mean, just no way around how horrible that would be.
We have 3 days to get out of London or something like that. Incredible.
Yeah, exactly. But I do think that the ocean strike, since there's so much more ocean than there is of land,
right.
percentage-wise, an ocean strike
it's
is
gonna happen.
Better than.
Yeah. I think so, too. Stay with us, Lloyd. We'll take phone calls next hour with you. Lloyd Pye, he's our guest. You're next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Lloyd Pye with us. We'll take your phone calls. Lloyd, tell me, though, a little bit about your friend Damon Elkins again from Arkansas and some of the work he's been working on.
Well, Damon, I introduced him to the audience on the last show, and we were talking about his work with the celestial mechanics that's visible in artwork in the past, both sculpture and painting and things like that. Does amazing work, but he's also now in the past year branched off into a study of the real, true Da Vinci Code. He believes that Da Vinci's paintings were meant to be overlaid with each other, and that they reveal secrets if you can do that, and he's finding different codes and things that Da Vinci had laid in, and I just think it's amazing, fascinating stuff that he's doing. He doesn't have all the answers yet, he's finding pieces, but he hasn't assembled the puzzle yet. But who knows, in another 6 months or a year, he may come up with something that is, again, a real, true Da Vinci Code that will, I think, everyone would be fascinated by.
I wonder what Da Vinci had up his sleeve.
You know, it's a very good question. He was obviously a man apart, in the way that Einstein was a man apart and others of his ilk. He just was so far ahead of his contemporaries that who knows where he got that ability. Maybe some of that was infused in him. Maybe he was a quote, special case or something, you know. But he obviously had, you know, the old Superman thing, powers and abilities far beyond those of mortal men. He did seem to have that. So if anybody would have the ability to lay in messages in overlays of painting, I would think it would be someone like him. So if you look at the work of a modern genius master like, say, Salvador Dali, where you see layers and layers of meaning in his work as well, it isn't that it's unknown or impossible, and so there's no reason why Da Vinci couldn't have been doing it in his own time, and that Damon has just sort of stumbled on to something here and is doing really interesting work.
Exciting. Okay, let's go to the phones. We'll pick it up by going to our first-time caller line. You're on the air with Lloyd Pye. Hi there. Happy Thanksgiving.
Hi, my name is Jeanette. I'm from Bakersville.
Hey, Jeanette. Go ahead.
I'm a psychic. I have communicated with the other side for most of my life, and I'm 61 years old.
Okay.
And I've been listening to your program for a little over a month now, and when I'm listening, I try to pick up things on whoever's talking, more or less to validate myself for myself and for the other person. And I've been sitting here thinking and meditating on Lloyd, and I see a pair of worn brown work boots, and like somebody like he's digging and hitting his toe with the shovel, cutting through the boot and damaging, hurting his toe. I'd say this probably was at least 20 years ago. And I don't know how I have this power, but things just come through my mind, and I just say whatever, you know, whatever is coming through. And a lot of the things he says I don't agree with. I don't know if he's an agnostic or if he believes in a higher power, but I think that if his what he does and his intelligence was spent trying, you know, to be diverted in a more positive way, that he could do a whole bunch for this world. He just sounds so intelligent, and I just can't see how he's diverted himself the way he has. But he's very interesting to listen to. I've really enjoyed it.
Well, thanks, Jeanette. So you got a compliment, I think, Lloyd.
It didn't sound like much of a compliment, but I'm willing to let it lie at that. I will say this, though. Anybody that knows me really well knows that I've stayed pretty much away from work boots as much as I've been able in my life. And that what you said earlier about the work boots and the shovel and all that, none of that rings a bell with me. So I don't even think that I have a pair. Well, I've got tennis shoes. That's basically it.
Let's go east
more
of the Rockies.
More than that is a little too much. But and as far as, you know, I can't tell you how many of my very close personal friends from my youth right on through would say pretty much the same thing as she said, that I've just completely wasted my life doing the things that I do instead of settling down and making a pile of money and bequeathing that to a family or something. And I just enjoy what I do, and I like it so much. And I think that in the end, you know, I like to say, you know, quote the saying, life is a four-lap race. This is my last lap coming up. I just turned 60, and I feel like I've got one more good one left in me, and I'm thinking it's going to be my best, and I feel like I can make some positive contributions to the world with the work that I'm doing, both with the Star Child and with the Hominoids and the Human Origins and stuff, and I feel like it's going to be a good ride if I can just keep it going, you know, stay alive, nothing bad happens, and...
Follow your heart and your
passion. I don't think I'm going to be sorry when it's all over with.
No, and you know what? Money is not a barometer of happiness or success.
I would agree. If you if you know any psychiatrist, they'll tell you that the unhappiest people out there are the rich folks, are the ones that made themselves rich, and they can't understand why that doesn't make them happy. And I don't. You'd struggle to find somebody happier than I am with what they do. You know, it'd be nice to be rich. It'd be nice to be able to do all things in the best way possible, but I certainly have a lot of fun. I enjoy my work. I enjoy my life. And if I never do get really rich, well, then it's a fair trade-off as far as I'm concerned.
Let's go east of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi. I'm Kay from Manchester, Connecticut. I have to tell you, George, you're such a wonderful, wonderful man that I stay up every night and I'm turning blue. I can't wait to hear you during the daytime. But anyway, I happened to see Lloyd Pye on a very short segment on television, ran right out and ordered his book, Everything You Know Is Wrong. Once I got it, because I too was looking for that connection right down to the truth of where we really came from, I read it and I was so thrilled because everything in his book rings so true, especially about the scientists. You know, they all have to agree. They don't want to lose any credibility.
Yep.
And so they won't allow progress to occur. And they don't give us humans, they're outside of their little castles of princely wisdom, to understand, you know, and, you know, their creations or what they've discovered. It's sort of secretive. But I ran out and I got a copy for both my sisters after that, and I said, you've got to read this. It's fabulous. I also got Zachariah Sitchin, and when I read Zachariah Sitchin, it was very good and it was in-depth. But Lloyd Pye's book, Everything You Know Is Wrong, if you order it, it just brings to life. Everything is so much simpler, even more so than stitching. And I wanted to say, I have been just singing his praises. Even my husband is thrilled about it and loves you too, George, and the show. So I'm buying a machine so I can tape it all night so I can go back to being a less of a vampire at night.
Get yourself a versicorder and just record it, and off you go.
I've got to do that. But there, I wanted to talk about the 2012 thing.
Sure, go
Everybody
ahead.
Thinks about the asteroids, and, you know, they're doing things right now. They're trying to do everything right now to, you know, if something gets to nudge them along. They already landed something on one of those things, and it's still going back to NASA. So I think they're going to solve that problem. And they said the next one that will really be a trouble, because my brother works for NASA, will probably be in 2033 or something.
Apophis comes by, I think.
Yeah, I suppose that's it. What bothers me is what I saw on the Science Channel at 2012. So they said, we're going to be have a clear shot from the Earth to the center of our Milky Way. And the problem might come if two planets collide and produce gamma rays that would give it a, you know, like when the sun flares hit Montreal, took out the sun. It just comes like that. Gamma rays, you would... Well, anyway, if that happened, the gamma rays would hit the Earth, and it would just about, we would just go out.
That would,
you know,
that would wipe us out.
You know, in the Bible, it says we would go in the blink of an eye. But also, I wanted to tell you that maybe we could get some kind of shield or something before then. But I wanted to tell you, I happened to come upon, because I've asked God to help me understand him, because God is not easy to understand. And these little things happened to me. Lloyd Pye, and which I believe with all my heart that the Anunnaki were, you know, had a major part in it. I came upon, I'm not a Mormon, but I came upon a Mormon thing who was saying ancient scriptures. And they started talking. I said, well, I'll listen to this a bit because it was in the beginning. I don't think in the Bible there isn't enough about what the beginning was like, because a lot of things happened in the beginning. Very little is written about it. They said that man was made by lesser gods, that God had ordered lesser gods to come to Earth to make man. And I thought, oh, my God, this just says, yes, Lloyd Pye is right again, you know, and with the Anunnaki. And I'm just very thrilled. And that business of a show you had on a while ago about giants, well, it just goes right with what Lloyd Pye has to say. These people, the Anunnakis, lived very, very long lives, and they were about 8 feet tall. They were very, very tall, and when they had intercourse with women, they produced giants. And it just all goes back to what Lloyd Pye wrote and what Sitchin wrote and what the ancient scriptures said. They were the fallen angels.
Absolutely. Lloyd, do you believe in angels?
Well, not in the biblical sense, no, but I do believe that where the idea of angels came from with the halos, you know, the symbology of angels is the halos. I think that comes from the fact, or the supposed fact, the written fact, that the Anunnaki themselves, if you looked at them just with your naked eye, just looked at them, they have a kind of a glow about them. They have an energy difference, obviously, from us or from what this planet supports normally. And they had a kind of a glow, an aura about them. And so I think that's where the idea of the halo or the halo symbology came down, to represent the gods or the angels when they would come to mortals after the, you know, in times later when they weren't there every day and weren't seeing them every day, where that would be a novelty, that you'd see somebody that had a kind of a glow around them or an aura around them. I think that's what angels are, and I think that's where the idea of angels has come down to us through history. But I'd also like to say that this lady, I do not know this lady, and I did not pay her to say all those nice things, but I wonder to know how much I appreciate her saying all those nice things.
West of the Rockies. You're on the air. Hi there.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Pye, I'm very pleased with what you have presented tonight. I have much knowledge, some of which you don't have, but you're probably at least 85% true on what you have presented tonight, both with the Bigfoot and the historical part of man. We had recently a Bigfoot that was shot three times in the back up in the Blue Mountains, pretty close to the Oregon-Idaho border. And I got that from a Bigfoot investigator. I don't know who the shooter was, but I may find that information. There was also a Bigfoot back east, that a young one that took a deer out of the back of a pickup, and I got that verified too. So they are real. And you're right on when the scientists do not want to let the public know the truth. I know of a case 4 years ago where a Bigfoot was shot up in the Blackfoot Reservation in Montana, and the government took it back east. It's not the only one they've got. So our scientists have the fact. They're making, trying to make fools out of those who are out here hunting for them, spending their time and money and the taxpayers' dollars on grants to hunt for Bigfoot. We've got a number of them right up here in the Blues, a few miles from where I live, and I live in Oregon. I've lived here since 1936. So I know a lot about what is and what isn't on and off the planet, because I'm working with the extraterrestrials that live on other planets, and I am able to communicate them with the implants that I have.
When did the implants go in, sir?
Started in 1943.
Oh, really? Man, you go way back then with
this. Yes, I'm one of the very first ones to see flying saucers. Have you ever seen one yourself?
No, I have not.
Well, there's a little secret to that. The only ones of us that see them are those that have implants.
Huh.
We are the children of those on other planets, and they watch over all of us.
Have you been checked out, x-rayed?
No, I can see them.
Where are they?
One's on top of my head, one's behind the left ear, and one's in the forward part of my brain, and they can send me colored pictures from anywhere in the universes.
Lloyd, you want to react to this? Thanks for this.
Well, boy, I'll tell you, it sounds like an interesting story. You know who he ought to get in touch with is Roger Lear.
Yes,
you know,
absolutely.
Put him in touch with Roger, and Roger will check him out for sure. And maybe
sounds like he doesn't want to lose his implants. Roger would go after him with his scalpel.
Well, Roger couldn't get the one in his brain, so I guess he could keep that one.
He'd try for it, though. I know Roger. I watched him in an operation, and there was an implant in a woman's cheek.
Uh-huh.
And every time he and the surgeon tried to grab it, this thing would move, Lloyd. It would, like, run away from the forceps.
I've heard Roger tell stories like that, that these things, you know, they know when you're coming after them.
Yeah, yeah.
It's fascinating stuff.
But old Roger would do whatever he could to grab that out of that guy's skull. Talk about the Star Child's problems.
Right.
Oh, that's something else. You're having fun doing what you're doing, aren't you?
Oh, absolutely. I love what I do. I love it.
Would you recommend it to anybody?
I wouldn't recommend it to anybody. It's a fool's errand. It's one of the hardest ways to live in the world. I would not, believe me, if I didn't have to do this, if I didn't have some kind of, I must have an implant, too, that makes me do it. Because
you might.
It's crazy to live like this. It really is. I could have been anything. I could, like the lady was saying, you know, I could have been anything that would have paid and gave me a more comfortable life than this, for sure. But I can't imagine anything where I would have had as much fun and would have enjoyed it and really felt like I was accomplishing something and was going to leave something behind of lasting value. I don't think I could have done that in any other career.
Well, stay with us. Lloyd Pye is our guest. His websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And those of you, I can't believe tonight's Thursday now into Friday. I feel like I've lost a day. If you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com. Lloyd, did you ever meet the late John Mack?
No, I never did meet him, but I was in London when he died, unfortunately, and it was a real shock to all of us there when it happened.
Oh, we lost a great one there, didn't
Absolutely.
We?
Absolutely, but I tell you what, there was talk about, you know, conspiracy that he'd been run down and all. Those streets in London there, when you're not used to them, if you've ever been there, the traffic's coming from the way you don't expect. I mean, I had numerous close calls myself in the year that I was there. The streets are very narrow. The sidewalks are very close to the cars. I can see that late at night, 11:30 something after a dinner party. I can see that just being a, you know, a drunk driver hitting him just like what they said. He could very
absolutely
easily, you know,
veering off just a little bit, he would have gone over the curb and gotten into.
Yeah, exactly. Or John could have just not been paying attention. It isn't like the streets here. You look the wrong way when you step out into the street. You're looking the wrong way, and it could have been that too. So I saw it myself a number of times, and when it happened, it was like I said, yeah, I can see that. I didn't really believe that it was a conspiracy behind it.
We can ill afford to lose people
like
that.
Like him, no, he was a terrible loss, for sure.
Let's go back to the phones. Final segment with Lloyd Pye, Wildcard Line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello.
Yes, take it away.
Yeah, man. I'm so glad you took my call. I've got all this built up. I'm suffering from a little bit of a sensory overload.
okay.
I'm from Arkansas, and I'm working in New Orleans right now. What I want to get out, I've always known, I grew up in church, you know, living in the Bible Belt, you go to church, and
sure.
you hear the stories, the whale ate Jonah, Moses climbed the mountain, and everybody, I think, becomes cookie cutter. I'm a Christian, for the most part, but I struggle with the creation part. And that the thing with... I was going to reiterate on what he was saying about the giants, and a preacher that I listen to sometimes on TV about the fall of Lucifer and the angels from heaven. When they were cast out, they were cast to earth, okay? Whatever humans or whatever was here then, these angels of Satan mated, you know, had sex with the daughters of men, is the way he put it. And they had offspring of giants. And he was saying that Goliath was actually one of the last of these giants.
Yeah, I believe. Do you think these fallen angels were extraterrestrials or really angels?
So y'all blow me out of the water with the extraterrestrial. I'm struggling with that because I'm trying to put in my mind what people... the angel thing. I just started listening to your show about a week ago, and this part of my faith is really, really struggling with me.
No, I can understand. I mean, all and your life you've been taught angels, fallen angels, demons, devils, and now you're hearing other perspectives. It's not easy to get,
no,
is it?
No, I believe it. I believe it with all my heart. I mean, I know it's true, God. I mean, I know it is. And the thing about them not wanting to tell the mainstream public somewhat is true. People, you know, groups of people hear that. They're like, oh, you know, they're going to be like, well, there's no way that happened. There was Adam and Eve, and then there was this, and there was that, and that's the way it is because it's simple. When you throw in that mix that y'all are talking about, and that opens up questions. It's just awesome. Our similarities with this earth are too strong.
Absolutely.
Our percentage of water in our bodies being the same as the percentage of water in the earth. There's seven layers of skin in our body, just like there's seven layers of crust in the earth. You go through the seven layers of crust, and you get to the magma. You go through our skin, you get to our hot red blood. The grass and the trees grow out of the top layer of the earth, just as our hair grows out of the top layer of our skin. Half of the earth is covered in sleep at one time. The other half has got the sun, just as we sleep at night and awake. And I've always, that part right there, let me know that there was something more to it.
It's an interesting perspective. Lloyd, let's get your take on his perspective of fallen angels versus extraterrestrials.
Well, I think those are you know, allegorical stories, just like the description of the human body and comparing it to, you know, the earth is an allegorical description as well. And I think a lot of the Bible is allegory. It's just, as he said, simple stories designed to make complex things comprehensible to people who, at the time that the Bible was being written and created and these things were happening, were extraordinarily simple. And I'm not meaning simple-minded. They were like us. They just didn't have universal education in the way that we have it. So they were extremely provincial in their viewpoints, and to try to get larger, the concepts that we're wrestling with ourselves, trying to figure out the truth of things, what's really the truth behind them, to make that comprehensible to a simple, uneducated, you know, ignorant, not stupid, but just ignorant of facts mind, you couch it in stories, allegories, tales, fables, just like you do with children. And I don't mean to denigrate people who believe that by saying that they, you know, that they have the mentality of children, but that's where those stories come from, and that's, I think, what the purpose of them is. It's exactly what he says. It's simple. It's easy to grasp. It's easy to remember Jonah and the whale, and they're like fairy tales are for children. They're colorful, bright, memorable images to get certain messages and certain stories and certain rules and ways to live across to people. And I think that's where most of that came from, if that's answering his question.
All right, let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
I'm calling from Tennessee.
Hello, Ron.
It's the first time I've ever listened to you guys, and the reason I am is the fact that it's my rotation to work 12-hour shift on the holidays. My question is this. My wife and I were having a conversation the other night, and it started off as a joke, really. I asked her, I said, why do you think God made people different colors? The response was not anything what I expected to hear. She said, how do you know that some of them shipped in from other galaxies? She said, there's many, many galaxies. She said, my belief is that God is the God of this world and that there's many other gods out there.
Interesting theory. I've heard this before, Lloyd, so some people back up what his wife says.
Well, they do. I mean, you could very easily make the argument that we are the domain of a certain group of extraterrestrial beings, whether you want to call them gods with a capital G or gods with a small g, is really irrelevant. So if we're part of a territory and then there are other territories out there controlled by other superior beings, and that there's a hierarchy, and maybe those, you know, that a group of territories are then controlled by a higher group yet, you know, all of that's possible. All of that is absolutely possible. We do not know. That's why I call my book Everything You Know Is Wrong. When you really come down to it, George, I really believe this, in the next 200, 300 years, people are going to look back on our time today where we think we're so on top of everything, and they are going to look at us like we look back 200 to 300 years on people who thought that the Earth was the center of the universe, that the Earth was flat, and all of the really asinine things that they believed back then. That, you know, we look at and we laugh, the things that we believe today about virtually everything that we think we know is going to be as asinine to them as the things we look back on are to us. And I know it's a radical thing to say that, but I don't believe we know anything. I don't believe the Big Bang is real. I don't believe that gravity is the center of everything in the universe. I don't believe that any of the fundamental knowledge that we think that we have is going to stand up and to the test of time. Everything we know is wrong, and it's hard to accept that and hard to acknowledge. The fun is trying to find what we can know and pick that apart from what we're just not going to know in our lifetimes, and it's going to be up to future generations to figure out. But we can't get to that point until we establish at least the verities of knowledge that we can secure in our own lifetimes, and that's what I'm working toward. And I think if we can just do get one or two or three things sort of kind of right, it'll help succeeding generations get toward figuring it all out. Short of somebody coming down and landing on the White House lawn and telling us the truth, that's how we're going to have to do it, just chip away at it from the outside of the monolith of science and accepted knowledge, the common knowledge, because all that's wrong. I just believe all of that is wrong.
All right, next up, Wild Card Line, you're on Coast to Coast with us. You're on with Lloyd Pye.
Hi, happy Thanksgiving.
You too.
Why, thank you. I would like to first give out a shout-out to Monty. This is Lance Johnson from Topeka, Kansas. And second, I have a scientific challenge for you and your guest, Lloyd Pye, George.
Okay.
I have very little data, just scrutiny. First, you have a varied and broad audience. How many would you say there are worldwide?
Oh, it runs the gamut from 2.5 to 5 million people at any given night.
Wow. For Lloyd, why would you associate legends, with good respect for the people who really investigate them, with scientific conclusions?
All right, why would I, could you just say that again? I missed one part of it.
Why would you associate legends?
Legends?
Correct, and okay. Mythology with scientific conclusions.
Why would I associate them?
Yeah.
I have no idea what you're trying to say here. I'm sorry.
For example, the animals that are mythical, excluding the Indo-Hobbits, like the Bigfoot and the snowman, and, you know, also church stories, but that's sort of more difficult for me to comment on. I can comment on the snowman and the Bigfoot and the Hobbit.
Well, the Hobbit and the Bigfoot and the snowman, in scientific terms, are completely different. The Hobbit is supposed to be, I think the Hobbit is, no different, really, than the snowman and Bigfoot, just a smaller version of it. But if you're talking about how science perceives it, science doesn't perceive the Hobbit that way at all. I don't know what you're really saying. I'm sorry.
You know, he sounds like Robbie Benson, the actor.
Yeah, he does, kind
doesn't
of,
he?
Yeah.
He does. East of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Good morning.
Hi.
I'd like to ask a question about Bigfoot, if I could. I personally had an experience a long time ago in the summer of 69, so I know there's something out there, but if these things exist, how do they keep a viable gene pool, you know, to breed with? You know what I mean?
Well, they're as I was saying earlier, they have such a wide range to live in and inhabit. Almost, if not more than, half of the arable land. If you take away the ice caps, you take away the deserts, the land that has vegetation on it, the arable land, half of that is to human beings, is terra incognita. We don't really go there. We'll cut roads through it. We might skirt out into the edges, very, very edges of it, to go hunting or something. But it's just vast, vast tracts of land that we don't go into because it's just too hard to make our way there. That is where they live.
Well,
in deep forests and all. So they have plenty of land, so their populations are probably in literally the hundreds of thousands for them to maintain the gene pool. And I don't think their lives have changed very much, except for their habitat has shrunk over the last, you know, 20 million years.
That makes sense. It makes sense because, I mean, they've got to migrate and they've got to have some type of habits. I mean, you know, back in 69, we came across one in Fort Worth, Texas, believe it or not, right outside of Fort Worth, Texas. And it was real and it was alive and it was walking around. It certainly wasn't a guy in a suit. And I was just curious, you know.
We have them here in Florida. We have them in Louisiana. Look, they're in every single state, in every state in the Union, except Hawaii. They have reports of these creatures. In every state, they're everywhere. Everywhere you have forests, everywhere you have trees, you have these creatures. Their forests for them are their highways, their superhighways, and they just migrate from one to another. And when they're, you know, that's how people see them frequently, crossing roads and things like that as they're moving along.
Well, we're going to send you some tape to your website. The other night we were sitting back here. I live in the country, and we actually heard one. And, you know, I guarantee one thing. I've lived out here for years and years at the edge of nowhere, and behind us is a wildlife preserve, and we heard this thing hooting and hollering back here, and I've heard it a couple times, but my wife was with me, and we got some tape of it, so I'll send it up to your website and see what you think.
That'll be fine. I'd love to hear it. There are other people
I'll
ship it off to who study those things very with really good equipment, so we'll have some fun with that. Good.
Let's do that. And email me, if you would, too, at george@coasttocoastam.com.
Sure, George. We appreciate you. Have a good night.
Okay, I'd love to. I'd love to see what that sounds like.
Sure.
We've had some sounds of Bigfoot, and it does have this howl sound to it, but who knows?
Well, one of the people I would send it to would be John Johnson. He's the guy. He's doing some very good documentary work in this field. In fact, if you go to my website, lloydpye.com, there are some film clips of me answering questions about hominoids, about Bigfoot, and about the others. And John shot that footage, and he is one of the people that I would send it to. Jason Valenti up in Washington State, Chris Murphy, Daniel Perez. These are all guys who are doing really good, MK Davis, doing really good hardcore research on these things, and they jump all over anything like this that's of halfway decent quality.
West of the Rockies, your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yeah, happy Thanksgiving, gentlemen.
Thank you.
I was with David Icke in Vancouver here 6 or 7 years ago. I'm not sure exactly which. I apologize for that. But those skulls were brought to us to review. And I got to say, George, they are the most amazing things if you ever get a chance to have a close look at them. And,
oh, sure.
They're virtually translucent. Light kind of passes through them if you have a bright enough flashlight or whatever. And I was just wondering if Lloyd was the gentleman who brought them, or was it Ray? Have you been to Vancouver, Lloyd?
Yes, I have been to Vancouver about three times, I think. But the skulls were left in the care of Dr. Ted Robinson and Chad Deakin for almost a year. After I had run up, you know, all I could do and had fallen in the hole financially the first year, I turned it over to Ted because Ted is a craniofacial plastic surgeon, and Ted believed that Canada would be more open to this sort of thing than we are down here in the States. So I was very happy to hand the skulls over to him to give him the opportunity to get his expert associates and colleagues to evaluate them. And after a year of it, he had run into the same kind of brick walls that I had. His friends were not taking his calls anymore and were giving him a lot of grief over it. So he had to hand them back to me. But it might have been during that year, because I really don't recall. I met David in other places, but I don't recall meeting David in Vancouver. So it probably was when it was with Ted Robinson and Chad Deakin.
Lloyd, let's watch the National Geographic special Monday night and then get you on to get your reaction to it.
That'll be great. I'd love to come back.
We will go from there. And in the meantime, you take care and enjoy the next couple days of your Thanksgiving holiday with your new wife, Amy.
Yeah, thank you very much. And I wish everybody to have a wonderful holiday as well. And let's hope we get some good football over the weekend.
You got that right. For Dan Galante, Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Gina Salvati, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, Stephanie Smith, Alan Corbett, who's been helping us out for a few weeks, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. And what a dandy it will be. Until then, be safe, everyone.